Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Let Me Out, Unlock Your Creative Mind and Bring Your Ideas to Life by Peter Himmelman. Read by Peter Himmelman. Introduction. Are you afraid of your dreams? I'm not talking about your nightmares. I mean the good ones, your hopes, your blue sky aspirations. I know it sounds a little odd to be frightened of your own better future, but think about it. There's an internal critic in our heads that's always terrified, always on the lookout for danger. I'm not saying it isn't helpful, or even a lifesaver at times. If you were going to do something truly stupid, it'd be the first to shout, "Hey, idiot, don't stick your head in that bonfire." But that same critic can hold you back. Wanting to be an opera singer or an anesthesiologist, or wanting to run a marathon or lose 20 pounds or pilot a bathyscap or tell your mother you love her. These aren't fires to be avoided. They're flames you want to fan. So why does this protective voice regularly perceive these good dreams as threats and prevent you from pursuing them? Why is it that you're so much better at putting the brakes on your creative ideas than you are at making them come true? And what if you could change that? In the fall of 2011, artist Candy Chang found an abandoned building in New Orleans and turned it into a touchstone of hope, in part by using Hearst black paint and the word die. It's hard to picture anything that grim, eliciting optimism, but Chang's idea was as profound as it was elegant. After painting the entire building black, she stenciled this declaration on its side countless times in white. Before I die, I want to blank. Since she did this, hundreds of people have visited the site to fill in their own answers with colored chalk. Her experiment has since been covered extensively in media and replicated in cities all over the world. So before we embark, think for a moment about the abandoned buildings in your life, the goals you've given up on or put on hold for so long you no longer recognize them. How would you fill in that sentence? Before I die, I want to blank. I, too, have experienced firsthand what it's like to feel the pain and the joy of pursuing a dream. I'm a musician, a songwriter, and a performer. I've made 20 critically acclaimed recordings, including 5 albums of children's music. I've had 3 major label recording contracts. I've toured the United States at least 30 times. I've even performed in Soviet Central Asia. To my knowledge, I'm the only American rock musician to have ever played the Lenin Palace of Culture and Sport in Tajikistan. I've composed music for several films and network television shows, and I've been nominated for an Emmy and a Grammy. Ever since the 5th grade, I dreamed of being a rock star, and after years of hard work and abundant good fortune, I actually became one. Unfortunately, in the past few years, the internet has caused major disruptions in my business. In case you haven't heard, almost nobody's paying for music anymore. My cousin Lawrence, a diamond dealer from Chicago, asked me to explain the problem. By way of metaphor, I told him to cup his hands under his computer screen and imagine that all the diamonds he's trying so hard to sell simply fall into his hands for free. That's rough, was all he had to say. Indeed. As a result of the changes, I had to answer the question of what I wanted to do with my life again. The radical shifts I had to undergo led me to a place where you might be at this very moment, where being creative and following your dreams isn't just some fun idea, it's imperative. No matter if you're a high school student, a housewife, a parasailing instructor, or the CEO of an organic kale distributorship, you will find out sooner or later that the way you've been doing things up until now will eventually need to change. In my case, the way I used to do things definitely didn't work any longer. The upheavals I was experiencing prompted a serious need to recreate and rebrand myself. I was forced to conjure up the same red-hot creative resources I had brandished as a young man. I never considered that what I'd been doing when I was 22 and what I'd spent my adult life learning to master would simply stop being effective financially when I hit 52. That's when I understood. It wasn't a lack of knowing what I wanted to do that was holding me back. It was listening to that overprotective voice I mentioned earlier, my inner critic. Listening to that negative voice is something I've always been expert at, and hearing it kvetch that my dreams were no longer possible, that I should be confused about where to turn next was, at the time anyway, absolutely mesmerizing. I eventually realized that I just needed to find a new way of doing what I loved all along, writing music, performing, and working with other people to create music. Even though all the negative internal chatter was leaving me pretty depressed, I still believed I had something of value to share that the internet could never take away. It was around this time that I had what in retrospect seems like a lightning bolt of inspiration. This thing I've been doing most of my life, songwriting, with its unique combination of strict structure and free associative poetics, is actually a perfect metaphor for teaching about how ideas go from the mind and into the world. My next move was clear. Using music and the same techniques I used to write songs, I would start a business that helps individuals and organizations become more creative and fulfilled. So what happened next? Not a damn thing. For almost 2 years, I just sat on the idea like a duck on an egg. How, you ask, could I not follow through on such a critical insight into my future? Well, endlessly contemplating going on safari in Botswana is great, but until you actually pack your bags and hop on a plane, you can dream about the Duba concession in the far north of the Okavango all you want, and wind up still at your desk, still on the sofa, still lying awake in bed at 3 in the morning wondering, why am I still here? If you've ever had this experience of stalling and never quite getting down to the business of finishing anything, you're certainly not alone. Why was it so difficult for me to get a cup of coffee, turn on my computer, and start outlining the broad strokes of my new company? Why didn't I start going through my address book to single out contacts I thought could help? Why didn't I follow through with more concrete ideas and repeat the same process for several months until I'd achieved something tangible? For starters, I spent too little time thinking about how the new business might look in success, and too much time worrying about how I might feel when it inevitably failed to get off the ground. I spent time worrying about why it was all too hard, why I was underqualified to speak in front of large groups of people, and about the many ways I could embarrass myself for even trying. I'd answer emails, I'd talk on the phone, I'd browse the internet. Hey, I wonder what it costs to take a scuba diving vacation in Bali. Every imaginable distraction called me away from the task of actually sitting down and mapping out the first steps of my idea. And then, one day, I don't know exactly how to describe it, I simply stopped the mulling and started the doing. It was July 14th, 2011 to be exact. Why? Why that specific date? What happened that morning that distinguished it from all my other false starts? What unusual impetus propelled me that day from dreaming to sitting my ass in a chair and beginning the actual work? Somehow, I'd crossed an invisible line. There was an internal wince. The inner critic roared with disapproval, and then the intangible became tangible for the first time. I acted differently that day and did 3 simple things. First, I set a timer and gave myself 15 minutes to create a list of potential names for my company. Then I gave myself 10 minutes to make some thumbnail sketches of logo ideas. And finally, I took 10 minutes to look into purchasing domain names. That was it. These were 3 remarkably easy tasks, 3 tiny ideas. But the radical difference between that fateful morning and so many others was that I stopped the negative thinking and started taking the small but definitive actions toward my goal. They were not earth-shattering accomplishments, to be sure, but they were actions nonetheless. The concepts I continued to research from that day on became the basis for processes that underpin this entire book, processes by which anyone can learn how to make their ideas come to life. There are small leaps of faith I'll ask you to take as we go down this path, but for the most part, I'm going to show you a clear, practical route for success. Freeing yourself from the constraints of your fear is how you will reveal your innate creativity. I will show you a system that can be learned, practiced, and repeated. The techniques I will teach you in this book have been proven to work, and the more you learn to trust yourself, the easier your own transformational leap will become. Introducing Big Muse. My company, which I eventually called Big Muse, officially launched August 10th, 2011. That's the date I gave my first seminar at an artist's studio near the Santa Monica airport, walked out into the spotlight, and showed a group of skeptical but curious strangers who'd never before tried writing a song the process by which they could overcome the fear of trying something completely new. They silenced their doubts and moved step by step from simply being able to articulate their dreams to a state of transformational possibility, a tangible, physical result, a finished song. The song became their symbol, their metaphor, their proof that the process works. My finished song was Big Muse itself. Your finished song is your dream. And by learning to break your dream into small pieces, working on those small pieces without delay, and constantly course-correcting when necessary to ensure that you are pursuing something connected with your truest values and desires, you can achieve almost anything. In this book, as in my seminars, I will show you how to do the following. 1. Create more fearlessly. 2. Communicate more potently. 3. Finish projects that have stayed in the bits and pieces phase forever. 4. Make your ideas take shape in the real world. In less than 2 years, I went from merely dreaming about a new way to channel my music to working with Banana Republic, The Gap, Adobe, McDonald's, Frito-Lay, Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and many others. I was helping individuals within each organization learn to channel their own big muse, silence their inner critic, and accomplish real goals. Big Muse works and is so unique because of something I call the Bilateral Brain Bottle Opener Theory, or BLBBOT. Actually, no, I don't call it that. I just made it up. But opening your brain is pretty much what happens when you apply ideas. Big Muse combines scientifically proven cognitive methods with my own artistic methods to convert and unite left and right brain thinking into action. In this way, I'm utilizing some of the techniques of American psychiatrist Aaron T. Beck, who developed the science of cognitive therapy back in the 1960s. The theory in a nutshell is that someone like me, for example, who strongly believes that reinventing himself and starting a new career in his 50s is unrealistic, will be led by those beliefs to avoid taking the necessary action steps to accomplish his goal. Not taking action will further support those negative assumptions in a sort of cyclical fashion until the great wall of pessimism is erected. When you take what's known as adaptive steps, those small parts of a goal that help a person see only the small stones that make up the wall and not the imposing wall itself, negative beliefs can be exchanged for other more desirable beliefs, taking your dream out of your head and into the real world. But these are just concepts. What defines Big Muse and makes it so different from virtually every other self-help philosophy you may have tried are the techniques I'm about to share with you, techniques derived from applied artistic experience. In reading this book, you will learn how to take abstract intellectual models and translate them into real tools for creative practice through connective storytelling, stirring metaphors, and powerful and deceptively simple brain bottle opener exercises, each of which comes with annotations on its real-world applications. I've seen the Big Muse method work in real time, unblocking the minds of thousands of different people with completely different dreams. A high school senior in Minneapolis who dreamed of becoming a professional photographer, she followed the principles in this book and in 6 months sold more than $2,000 worth of photos at her first gallery showing. An IT executive in San Antonio, who initially dreamed of writing just one song. He followed the principles in this book and in less than a year recorded and released his first full-length CD, and it's currently getting airplay on a Texas radio station. A marketing director for an international restaurant chain who dreamed of stopping his drug and alcohol problem. He followed the principles in this book and got himself into a 12-step program. He's been sober one full year at the time of this writing. He also earned the respect of his bosses and got a promotion. A wounded warrior from Virginia who dreamed of saving a marriage that was on the verge of divorce. He followed the principles outlined in this book and has become a more expressive, more demonstrative husband. His family life is finding its way back on track. In every case, these people achieve their goals by making that leap of faith and then taking that first step. Our time on earth is limited, and there are important things we all want to accomplish before we run out of it. The journey we undertake together in this book leads to a treasure, one you may have buried in your heart long ago, and reading this book will help you find it. I'm not going to show you how to merely mull over your dreams or contemplate them endlessly, or ruminate, or ponder, or dwell, or obsess. I'm going to help you pluck your dreams from your head and plant them here in time and space. Whether you're a social studies teacher who wants to fly a plane, an actuary who wants to play the jazz trombone, a Navy SEAL who wants to write poetry, a special education counselor who wants to make artisan cheeses, a COO of a huge corporation who wants to spend more time with your family, a 10th grader who wants to learn to play the ukulele, a bicycle mechanic who wants to be a Buddhist monk, or a Buddhist monk who wants to be a bicycle mechanic. You've already taken the first step by reading this far. Give yourself credit and consider it the first step on the trek of a lifetime. Think about that blank space again. Before I die, I want to blank. That dream you've held so close to the vest that perhaps you're the only one who knows about it. If my story of stalling, always stalling, and never actually getting anything accomplished sounds familiar, read on. This book will pinpoint the internal forces that keep you from getting down to business, and it will show you how to outsmart them. Take a break from your doubts and fears, and get ready to let out your own big muse. Part 1. The Challenges. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. Howard Thurman. Chapter 1. Meet Marv. Explaining the negative voice within. Why do so many of our best ideas go down the drain with the soap before we can even reach for the towel? It's not that way for everyone, is it? We all know people who are able to follow through on their ideas, and we wonder, are they born with certain gifts the rest of us lack? Do they share some common set of actions or beliefs? I always hear people say that if you want it, just do it, as if just doing it were the most natural thing in the universe. Just lose weight. Just start a business. Just find a wife. Just learn to draw. Just learn to fly a helicopter. Why is just doing it so hard? It's hard because we've got a voice in our heads that's constantly yammering about our deficiencies and filling us with fear. But what exactly is that annoying negative voice? What is its function? It must have an important one because everyone I've ever met has got the same voice inside. My firm belief, and I'll illustrate this idea extensively throughout the book, is that this negative voice does not represent an enemy as some writers have suggested. Rather, it's a very real and integral part of our psychological makeup, one that cares strongly about our own survival. In that sense, it's not something to be eradicated or pushed away, as if we could push it away. It's a part of us that needs to be valued and understood. It's funny how the needs of this internal critic are so similar to our own needs. The similarity exists because it is us. To humanize this internal critic, I've given it a name, Marv. Marv is what my wife and I would call our oldest son Isaac whenever we traveled, and he'd start complaining or asking ridiculous questions of the "Are we there yet?" variety. We'd ask, "Who let Marv in the car?" By the way, if your name is Marv, take no umbrage. I mean no offense. please just think of MARV as an acronym for Majorly Afraid of Revealing Vulnerability. The keys to the car, specific, present, and true. Just as my wife and I wouldn't have dreamed of letting our little Marv behind the wheel, we shouldn't entertain the thought of letting internal critic Marv take our dreams on a wrong-way drive. Yet, how often do our boldest plans wind up in a ditch or stalled on the side of the road? What we need is a map, one that shows us not just a destination, but directions on how to get there. We also need to keep Marv in the back seat, buckled up in a safety belt where he belongs. Marv will give you space and allow your dreams to manifest themselves if you keep the following three qualities in mind. Your dreams must be specific. Dream as big as you like, but make sure your dream is specified and broken down into small actionable pieces. Don't think, "I want to become a baseball star," without also thinking, "I'm going to the ballpark now to practice my swing for 30 minutes. Present. Don't just think, "I'll start practicing sometime midweek." Instead think, "I'll go to the ballpark at 10:35 this morning," and then actually go. True. Don't pursue the dream of being a baseball star because your dad pressured you into it. The dream itself must be self-generated, and it must be something you want to pursue for your own sake and of your own volition. It's a point of pride for many of us when we consider the dozens of times in our lives when our ideas were undervalued or criticized, but we went forward with them anyway. Our sense of pride wasn't necessarily for the things we'd eventually created, but for the very fact that we overcame Marv's voice and the critical voices of others. Unchecked external criticism, such as bad reviews or people not buying tickets to your show, always generates internal criticism. And people's negative comments aren't mere gasoline for Marv. They're rocket fuel. He becomes hyper-energized and goads you into quitting whenever he hears others criticize you. Why is this? You see, Marv fears for our safety and well-being. As infants, when we depended on our parents for our very survival, Marv was there as well, and he sensed correctly that if we were abandoned, we would die. Apparently, he hasn't gotten over that frightening realization, because though we've all grown up in the physical sense, most of us have never fully outgrown those primal concerns surrounding abandonment and our own mortality. The fear that we feel when we try something new, something particularly challenging, isn't some petty worry. It's actually a mortal fear. That's why, when we want to reinvent ourselves by following our dreams, Marv's sway over us is still so strong. But like I mentioned earlier, Marv isn't trying to hurt us. He's trying to save our skins. If a voracious lion were on the attack, it would be Marv who compelled us to flee for our lives. He's ever vigilant, with his hand constantly on the lever that squirts the adrenaline into our bloodstreams and the life-saving anxiety into our brains. He's got such a one-track mind about helping us that he simply hasn't heard the news. Marv, our lives are not in danger anymore, so please relax. Why Marv Can't Relax: Woolly Mammoths and the Brain Science of the Inner Critic. Nobel Prize-winning neurobiologist Roger Speary suggested that human beings are essentially of two minds. His pioneering brain hemisphere research in the early 1960s led to a well-known and largely misunderstood theory about left and right brain thinking. The idea is that the left brain is oriented towards straightforward, analytical, numerical, this-is-the-way-things-are type thinking, while the right brain is oriented toward a dreamy, this is the way things could be type of thinking. While many leading psychologists still support Speary's idea, those in the field of neuroscience have never fully accepted it, believing instead that the brain is far more complicated than his dual hemisphere theory suggests. But regardless of where creativity is located in the brain, human beings clearly have two distinct capacities, one for logical thinking and one for more fluid, amorphous thinking. So, for example, when you get up to brush your teeth in the morning, your left brain's logical functions will have all the warmth of an engrossed police detective. Just the facts, ma'am. Grab toothbrush, put toothpaste on toothbrush, put toothbrush in mouth, scrub. The logical mind is geared towards survival as well. It's ever on the alert in case a woolly mammoth or some other beast from our primordial past attacks us. The logical mind's no-nonsense orientation comes in handy when we need to get out the door and on our way to an important appointment. The more fluid right brain functions, by contrast, are creative and deal well with constantly shifting dynamics. The fluid brain favors artistic considerations. It is oriented to the metaphorical, considers all possibilities, and thrives on weighing endless variations. It also loves the realm of dreams and desires. So, let's pretend for a minute that you could shut off your analytical mind, leaving only your fluid mind to brush your teeth. It might sound something like this. Oh my God, the toothbrush handle. It's pink and translucent. And when I hold it up to the light, it's like a neon eel. Wait a minute. What is color anyway? And how did cavemen clean their teeth? Teeth. I love the hard sound of the letter T. No doubt you'd have a lot of fun, but you'd never get your mouth clean, and you'd miss that crucial appointment. But how does this all relate to Marv? Simple. There is a crucial part in the creative process in which you have to let the fluid part of the mind dominate. You can't think about reviews, impressing friends, your paycheck, or the size of your trophy. Not that those are irrelevant concerns, but they exist strictly on the analytical mind's home turf with things like judgments, measurements, and return on investment. When you embark on making dreams specific, present, and true, you have to start by diving in and immersing yourself in the work at hand. You have to surrender control. The brain's more fluid capacities are built to brave the unknown and all its possibilities. The analytical part of the brain, still on the lookout for a woolly mammoth after all these eons, doesn't like that. And so, to shake you out of the dream state that's about to commence, that is, being immersed in the warm flow of a project where you'll lose track of time and drop your guard, it's going to play dirty. Here's what the analytical mind and its pal, the meek and methodical Mr. Marv, might say to you. See how many of these inner critic potshots sound familiar as you think about getting something accomplished. This idea is really stupid. You know, all your friends will laugh at this. What makes you think you have anything to say? What's in the fridge? Isn't it time to check your email again? This lighting isn't quite right, is it? Marv is going to bombard you with distracting thoughts. When it's told it's not in control anymore, the analytical brain fights for your survival. Why? Because you can't afford to shift gears when there's an enraged woolly mammoth just around the corner. Now, this can come in handy. You wouldn't want to daydream about writing a children's book while you were walking down a menacing city street at night. But in the overwhelming majority of situations, the challenge remains one of A, calling off Marv's mammoth patrol, and B, increasing the chances for what I call an hourglass moment, that sacred time when an idea is birthed through action, with the fluid part of the brain leading the way. But as you know from personal experience, Marv isn't going to give up easily, and of all the weapons at his disposal, perhaps none is more potent than those remembered critical voices we met in the throes of our youthful uncertainty. Marv and Criticism, The Unusual Case of Mr. Fuff and the Flying Sonic Football. I know certain people who insist they're impervious to criticism and Marv's warnings. For your own good, don't believe them. They're just plain lying. The image of these people skipping through life untouched by anything but their own invariably positive muse does not correlate with reality. Everyone hates rejection. And the problem isn't so much that these folks are lying, which they are. It's that we believe such people exist, and then we feel horrible, we're not like them, that we're somehow deficient. Let me assure you again, everybody is affected by criticism. We love it when people praise our work, and we abhor it when they dismiss it. That's human nature, and it's unchanging. The only difference is that some of us are stopped in our tracks by the critical voices, while others of us keep going. On my path to becoming a professional musician, I experienced countless disparaging moments. Here's one. It was 1980. I was 20 years old, living in Minneapolis, and a revolutionary new dance song called Funky Town by Lips Inc. ruled the charts. The damn thing was everywhere. On the radio, in elevators, at clubs, even playing overhead in the frozen food section at the Red Owl. As fate would have it, Funky Town was written by Steven Greenberg, the multi-talented drummer of The Kinship, Minneapolis's most popular bar mitzvah and wedding band. Soon I was going to his place once or twice a week to play him demos of things I'd written, to get his opinion, and to interest him in helping me with my career. Truth be told, there wasn't a lot of pleasure in taking my stuff to him for an evaluation. After all, it was so easy for Steve to criticize my music. All he needed to do was raise his eyebrow or give a little laugh, as if what he was hearing was the stupidest idea ever. Steve was a gatekeeper, or so I thought, and all my energies at the time were spent trying to create something I thought he'd like. One afternoon I sat in my bedroom and wrote a song I was extremely pleased with. It was about a friend of my parents named Irwin Fuff. Mr. Fuff was odd. He'd been a Holocaust survivor, and I'd heard stories of him running alone through the woods in Poland as a young child. A few days before I wrote the song, my mom called me into her room and told me the police had found Mr. Fuff's wife, Reva, lying dead in their kitchen. Mr. Fuff had killed her. Since he'd had a history of mental illness, the prosecutor felt there was no need for a trial. Irwin Fuff went straight to a mental institution, where they pumped him full of so much Thorazine, an antipsychotic drug, that he was only semi-conscious most of the time. The trouble was that in the early mornings, the brief time between when the previous day's dose wore off and the new day's dose was given, Mr. Fuff would regain some degree of consciousness and could feel some of the horrible grief and shame over having murdered his wife. It was during such a small window of lucidity that he took his own life, just days after arriving at the hospital. The song I wrote was called Cursed with What It Means. The chorus went like this. She will sleep forever. You'll be high on Thorazine. She will sleep forever. You are cursed with what it means. I raced to Steve Greenberg's place, cassette in hand. This was a whole new style of music, dark and spare, with intense lyrics based on a true story, and I knew he was going to love it. I put the cassette in his giant Marantz stereo and let the music fill the room. When the song finally trailed off, Steve got up off his recliner and walked towards the stereo. He had a big smile on his face, so naturally I assumed he'd turn up the volume and play the song again. But instead, he ejected the cassette and hiked it between his legs like a football center. It flew up into the air, end over end, until it crashed into the brickwork of his fireplace. Steve's intentions were always righteous, I knew that, but his tough love was, well, it was really tough. I stared at the tape cartridge, now in pieces, and wondered how all my passion and enthusiasm for this song had vanished in less than 4 seconds. I'm not sure how long it took me to recover from the sound of that cassette crashing into the fireplace, but I assure you, there was a recovery period. If you're embarking on something new, you must have a strategy in place to protect yourself from the inevitable criticism that will take place when you take your ideas to market. And I'm not necessarily talking about a business marketplace. It could be a fear of communicating honestly in a relationship. It could be about letting someone take a first look at your manuscript or a book of poems. It could even be a fear of criticism when discussing party ideas for a friend's birthday. In the following chapters, we're going to look at ways that I and others have allowed our own Marvs to relax. Brain Bottle Opener 1. Why You? Let's start with an easy and incredibly practical tip that I use almost every day. If you find it hard to begin taking the first steps toward your goal, set a timer for 3 minutes. That way there won't be this daunting glob of time staring you in the face. 3 hours is intimidating. 3 minutes is not. Just start in with whatever small part of your goal you choose. I typically find that when that 3-minute alarm goes off, I'm aloft and doing what I was afraid to do just minutes before. But for now, I'd like you to take no more than 3 minutes to write down the answer to this question. Why are you here? If that's a little too philosophical, try this. What is your purpose in life? If that's too general, then try, what do you stand for? Or what would you give your life for? Or what's the reason you get up in the morning? Or even, what would you want your friends and family to say about who you are? You might not think a book about unleashing your creative potential has much to do with these big questions, but I believe answering them, or beginning to answer them, helps us to reduce our fear of failure, which helps us to take immediate action toward the fulfillment of our dreams. Knowing who you are, what you stand for, and what you will or will not do for fame or fortune gives you strength. Strength of character and strength of purpose. That strength is what allows Marv to put down his guard for a while. After you've written your why you statement, keep it close at hand because it'll provide you with impetus and understanding as we move through the various parts of the Big Muse process. Note, if you give yourself 3 minutes to try this and can't think of anything to write, can't think of anything that defines your life's purpose, then consider the fact that you don't know a very valuable piece of information, something to solve later. Real-world applications. Use this BBO before undertaking any large-scale project or decision. For example, let's say you're a young dentist, just married. Your wife is a fifth-grade teacher, and you've been offered a job in a new city. You're trying to assess whether to take the offer. Doing a why you statement will give you a profound source of information to guide you through the decision-making process. Chapter 2. History's Heavy Hand. Disconnecting Mar from the pain of your past. When I was 12 years old, I was the lead guitar player of a 4-piece rock band. We were a miserable group of 6th graders. I was the worst of the bunch by far. I was such a malevolent and egomaniacal little prick that once, when I felt our rhythm guitar player, Sean, was making a play for my role as lead, I fomented a conspiracy against him that resulted in every kid in the neighborhood festooning Sean's purple Vox teardrop electric guitar with boogers. In the end, it looked like some decoupage project gone entirely wrong. At the time, I had no idea that my negative thinking was directly proportional to my feelings of fear and vulnerability. How could I have known? I was just a kid, after all. And instead of being self-reflective, perhaps saying to myself, "This is just Marv coming to defend me against a potentially frightening situation," which, of course, would have demanded a level of maturity I simply didn't possess, I did cruel and stupid things to make myself feel stronger. A short while after the booger incident, our band performed at the Peter Hobart Elementary School spring concert. We played so well, in fact, that we immediately secured our first professional engagement. $5 for the whole band and all the orange pop and Doritos we could stomach. But I was nervous. The gig was at United Cerebral Palsy of Minnesota, and aside from my other moral shortcomings, I had this terrible habit of laughing uncontrollably at the misfortunes of others. If someone was to trip and get hurt, or If a waitress was to drop a tray of dishes, I'd find that hysterical. I was afraid that I'd take one look at these physically challenged people and laugh at them too. The first person we saw that night in St. Paul had hydrocephalus, water on the brain. His head was so disturbingly elongated that to my 12-year-old mind, it looked like a flesh-colored stovepipe hat. A woman who had no hands was drawing a landscape with a green crayon fixed between her toes. A pretty teenage girl who seemed perfectly normal, except that she had only one layer of skin, was standing near the stage. We could see her dark veins as clearly as we saw her eyes. When we finally started to play, the crowd went wild. The guy with hydrocephalus was rocking back and forth so hard I thought his wheelchair was going to break. The woman with no hands was clapping to the music by pounding her feet on the table, and the girl with one layer of skin was dancing just in front of the band. We only had 6 songs, so we kept playing them over and over until something incredible happened. I suddenly became aware that the voices of fear in my head, the same ones that had made me so defensive that I'd laugh at people's misfortunes and foment booger conspiracies, had vanished. It was like a wave of calm had emptied out my mind. And in that space, that fearless nothing, if you will, I suddenly felt a sense of pure joy as all my self-critical words melted away. Though I hadn't yet given him a name, I was already beginning to feel what it was like when Marv gets up and goes away. Not only did I not laugh at anyone, that evening in St. Paul was the first time I remember experiencing a real sense of purpose. I was bringing joy to people and being made joyful in return. When I looked over at the other guys in the band, I could tell they felt it too. On the way home, I realized something in me had shifted. I was too young to adequately express the feeling, but it was somehow clear to me. Acting in the moment, acting generously, and doing what I love to do is how I can get Marv to leave me alone. Fearless Nothing. A few years ago, I read W.H. Auden's poem in memory of W.B. Yeats. One line in particular, "Poetry makes nothing happen," caught my attention. Auden had written the poem in tribute to his mentor Yeats in 1940, at the dawn of World War II. The words made perfect sense. How could any poem, any piece of music, any painting, or any simple act of kindness, which is its own kind of poetry, possibly stand up to mass murderers and tyrannical governments? But days later, when I looked at the line again as "poetry makes nothing happen," it began to take on an entirely different meaning. In that moment, I saw Auden's nothing as awareness without fear. I came to believe, and still do, that both great works of art and simple acts of grace allow us a kind of empty space from which to view the world and our lives without preconceptions, without prejudice, a non-judgmental vantage point where we can divorce ourselves from tired ways of looking at things and then, and only then, become the truly creative beings we are meant to be. As I understood it, Auden was describing the state of mind from which change of any kind becomes possible. It was then I knew that I needed some practical methods to be able to get space from Marv any time I desired. No matter how much fear Marv tries to sell us, we should never attempt to banish him or shut him up forever. We treat him with respect because even though he can seem like the most annoying force in our lives, he's always trying his best to be our protector and save us from shame and abandonment. The problem, as we all know, is that he just works way too hard. We may feel like shoving a dirty sock into his mouth, but what we really need to do is give him a cup of coffee and a copy of the New York Times and tell him to take a little break. Then, while he's away, comfortably sipping his latte and reading the paper, we can do our best work. We need to send him off because the very human impulse to create is so powerful and so much a part of our genetic makeup. There are some of us who might rightly ask, why strive to be creative at all? Maybe life would be better, or easier at least, if I just sat around watching Seinfeld reruns and eating Ben and Jerry's. Fair enough, but my response is that following our dreams isn't just a way to get ahead or to be well-liked or to be a productive citizen. Our creativity, that is, our fearless engagement with the world around us, is the source of our happiness and purpose on this planet. Constantly ruminating about what we've achieved in the past or thinking about what results we'll purportedly get in the future has a way of disconnecting us from experiencing that joy. The key to joy is working actively in the present, as opposed to constantly being stuck considering outcomes. Creativity resides in our present tense efforts to make order from the chaos around us. The great painter Georgia O'Keeffe famously said, "I've been absolutely terrified every moment of my life, and I've never let it keep me from doing a single thing I wanted to do." When we take simple, positive actions in spite of our fear, our minds and our possibilities expand. On the other hand, whenever we get wrapped up in negativity, our minds and our possibilities contract. The actions we take don't have to be huge or heroic. They might be terribly modest things like saying thank you to a restaurant server and meaning it, or making your wife some banana pancakes for the sole reason of seeing her smile. Just as there are specific steps to be taken in the service of our career-oriented dreams, there are specific steps to be taken in the service of the larger dream we all have for ourselves, the dream of one day being happy, impassioned, and fulfilled. Expansion, contraction, and the curse of comparison. At times we become so caught up in the machinations of our daily lives that we forget such a goal is even possible, that happiness is even within the realm of consideration. Our dream might be about starting a business or learning a new language. It could just as easily have to do with seeking out people we long to be with or acting on a desire to deepen our current relationships. As I've said before, every goal is obtainable if we break each one down into individual, doable parts, do the actions in the present, and make sure that what we are doing is true to our own values and not something foisted upon us by pressure or control. You'll notice that a couple paragraphs back, I used the words expand and contract. I try not to rely on the words succeed and fail. Too often we're caught up in the trap of thinking in assessment terms. There's finality about succeeding or failing that often doesn't ring true. It's what happens to a character at the end of a book or movie. But life doesn't work that way. It's more nuanced, more ambiguous. We're not coming to the end at the end of a day, the end of a job, or even the end of a relationship, though it may well feel as if we are. While we're still alive, it's far too early to take a tally or publish a scorecard. Our lives already have way too many assessments. Expansion and contraction are concepts that suggest dynamic states as opposed to dead judgments. They also imply that every situation we find ourselves in, whether that situation goes in our intended direction or not, is in fact just one more learning opportunity. By choosing to define yourself as a success or a failure, you're also forced into making rigid assessments about your self-worth in comparison to others. If you're not comparing yourself with your friends and neighbors, then you're making comparisons with the fictional characters who pose as humans in magazines and on television. You'll then find that you are constantly anxious about where you should be in your life as opposed to where you are in your life. When we're in the habit of comparing ourselves with everyone around us, it simply means that we've become seduced by the sound of Marv's voice. Instead of sending him away for a few hours, we're sitting at his feet and listening to him as though he's Moses. When we're attentive to him, we guarantee one thing. We will be unable to make our dreams manifest. Here's why. We are not being specific. We are thinking about our lives as one big insoluble problem and casting a negative light on all of it. If we were taking time to address a small, specific, problematic aspect of our lives and focusing on it alone, as opposed to viewing our entire lives as some giant, amorphous ball of chaos and confusion, we could address our challenges in a proactive and creative manner. That's called helpful problem solving, a creative endeavor, if ever there was one, as opposed to obsessive thinking over things we can't change. We are not acting in the present. We have a tendency to think only about the future consequences of our perceived misfortune. We are imagining negative scenarios for ourselves in some distant future in which everything portends gloom and doom. We are not being true. We are not basing any of our thoughts or actions on things we truly desire. Since we are comparing ourselves and our circumstances to others, we become incapable of looking at our own uniqueness, our own desires, or our own aspirations. Rather, we're being led into some kind of dim reverie of negativity. We humans are not static, and to speak about our lives in terms of failure or success suggests that we have somehow stopped. The journey of our lives is just that, a journey. We're still in process, still in motion. I prefer to ask, does the course of action I've taken at any given moment expand my potential, both in terms of a particular goal and my overall happiness, or does it contract the possibilities? I'm also suspicious about the value of constantly declaring what we are. Sometimes we give ourselves proud appraisals. I'm an artist, a dentist, a research scientist. Other times we label ourselves negatively. I'm not creative, not outgoing, not disciplined. The weight of these kinds of pronouncements and the energy we expend attaching ourselves to them are only limiting. I'm aware that we have some evolutionary need to make snap determinations about one another, who's liberal, who's conservative, who's got the heft of academic or professional success behind them, and who doesn't. Sure, we love our name tags, but the problem is that we don't just wear them. We often believe that we are them. Whether we're proud of our identities or degraded by them, the names we give ourselves should never be mistaken for who we are. What truly define us are our core values, the ideas, the conversations, and the actions we engage in. Simply put, those things must be nurtured if they expand our minds and the minds of others, and rejected if they contract them. The Zen tradition teaches that at our core, each of us is just an observer. We are not what we've achieved or what we own. We are simply the consciousness that looks out at the world from behind our senses. When we lose ourselves in the storm of negative emotions stirred by our senses, when we lose knowledge of ourselves as simply observers, we surrender our ability to act with freedom and creativity. We become, in a sense, slaves to Marv. Elephant ropes and the abrasions they cause. In India, elephant handlers train baby elephants to be submissive by chaining them to a post. The baby elephants fight with all their will to break free. Day in and day out they try, but eventually they just give up. When they become adults, they no longer need chains to tie them in place. Just a thin rope will do. Of course, an adult elephant with its tremendous strength is perfectly capable of breaking the rope, but since its experiences as a baby have convinced it otherwise, it never tries. This is how some circus trainers keep elephants captive. In many ways, we're not much different from those elephants. Our own painful past experiences are capable of limiting us in a similar fashion, and it's worth taking a look at some of the ropes each of us has tied around our own ankles. Being aware of what these look and feel like is important. The more we know about the causes of our own fear, the less ground Marv has to stand on, and the less convincing his arguments will be. But looking at a memory that has created our elephant ropes can be frightening. especially for people who have suffered crippling emotional, physical, or sexual abuse. When I think back on the elephant rope breakthroughs I've made over the years, moments of discovery when I realized just how I'd been fooling myself into thinking I was trapped or chained, I'm always amazed at the innocence behind the experiences. I mean, we've all had traumatic moments in our lives of some sort, and yes, those moments can certainly become elephant ropes, but more often than not, the ropes that are the most constraining and damaging are ridiculously subtle. They stay just under the radar. They have to, or else we'd recognize the illusion and they'd lose their power. As you will hear, many of the examples I've drawn from my past in helping to explain Marv and his sneaky ways of stifling our creativity are from my childhood. There are two good reasons I like to go back to my early years. The first is that creativity takes place in the mind of a child. I'm an adult, you say. Yes, but even so, your childlike mind is still very much a part of you, although clearly for many that childlike mind has become difficult to access. The second reason is that shame has its root in innocence, and shining a light on Marv's toolbox usually requires traveling back in our childhoods to those naive moments of an elephant rope's first weaving. An elephant rope of mine. I remember one such incident in the late summer of 1972. It was a scary time for me. Soon I'd be going to junior high and meeting all sorts of new kids. I wasn't good at sports, and in Minnesota everyone played either football or hockey. The girls seemed to really be attracted to the jocks with their shoulder pads and hockey sticks, and I felt like I'd never be able to compete for their attention. One afternoon, my parents were gone for the day, and I called the guys in my band and asked them to come over for a rehearsal. We set up in the garage and started running through our songs. After a while, the music was sounding so good, we opened the garage door so everyone in the neighborhood could hear. 20 minutes later, small groups of kids started walking over to watch us. Kids from other elementary schools would be going to my junior high a month from then. It was exciting, and pretty soon the trickle of kids had grown to a crowd, including some really cute girls I'd heard about but never actually met. To my good fortune, our rehearsal had turned into a full-blown rock concert, and after we'd played for an hour or so, all the guys who were getting very rowdy started filing into my house and into the basement. It was then that I blasted an 8-track of Jimi Hendrix through my brother's enormous speakers, which lit up in different colors to the beat of the music. I started going wild and whipped off my tank top, spraying my underarms with a can of Right Guard in perfect time to Jimmy's guitar solo. I thought it was hilarious, and all the guys were playing air guitars with orgasmic expressions on their faces. All I could think about was how great I felt and how popular I'd be with all these new kids in the fall when school started. When we finally went outside to cool off, there was a group of incredibly cute girls in my driveway. There they were, at my house. This was the moment I'd been waiting for. These girls were going to fawn over me. To this day, I can still remember feeling supremely confident as I walked toward them. And then, the record-scratching moment of panic as one dark-haired girl named Janelle suddenly blurted out, "Himmelman, you're so immature. You're not even ready for seventh grade." No one came to my rescue. Janelle's foxy friends just nodded in agreement. Worst of all, Marv nodded in agreement. And an elephant rope slipped firmly around my leg for, I'd say a good 20 years or more. Cue the sad violas and the lonely oboe. Today, looking back on that moment, I don't see a loser at all. I see an incredibly creative and interesting kid who was doing something entirely different from what anyone going into Westwood Junior High was doing. I had my own band. We were playing my original songs. I was into Jimi Hendrix, and I was daring and funny enough to spray deodorant on my underarms as a percussion instrument. I'd love that kid if I met him today. As I think about Janelle and what she said, I wonder why I didn't just stare her down and say, "What do you know about maturity? You're 12. As it turned out, Marv had seized on that moment and had said, "Peter, I told you not to do weird things. No one's going to understand your sense of humor, and no one cares about you or your music, so please don't embarrass yourself anymore. Just try to be quiet and fit in this fall, okay? Seventh grade's a big deal, and you've really blown it today." Brain Bottle Opener 2, Elephant Ropes. Take 5 minutes to discover and write about one of your own